This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, dreams and fathers. Bruce Beasley writes poems that are equal parts essay, song, and magic spell. I'd come across one of them, Eccentric Votive Offering, in the magazine, and it read like a to-do list or a recipe. But what we were making or preparing for, I couldn't quite tell. All I knew was that I carried around the poem for a few days, reading it out loud to myself, and it hypnotized the hell out of me. So I got in touch with him, and we talked about his upcoming collection titled Proverb, Enigma, Hallelujah. Bruce Beasley is originally from Macon, Georgia, but he now lives and teaches on the other side of the country, in Bellingham, Washington, close to the Canadian border. Since we talked over the phone, I was curious to know where he was sitting.
I'm in my little writing cottage in the back of my house.
What does that look like?
It's a converted garage, but it's very cozy. A neighbor of mine who's a carpenter built it for us. It's got a little wood stove and fresh milled wood and a loft up on top. Oh. And a giant bookshelf with shelves on both sides of it. But even then, there are books piled up on the stairs to the loft.
I know that problem.
Yeah.
I wanted to start with something that you seem to have been interested in for a very, very long time. Dreams.
Yes.
In a poem from your 1996 collection, Summer Mystagogia, there's this mention, a few lines only, from my dream diary, age 10.
Yes.
Well, I'd love for you to read just that little part.
Sure.
But I'd also like to know how you got into recording your dreams so early on.
I don't know. I don't remember why I recorded them. You know, I was 10 years old, and it was a long, long time
True.
Ago.
Yeah.
This is from a longer poem called A Mythic History of Alcoholism. And in this poem, I was telling the story of my family, my parents' alcoholism, through a series of different mythic lenses. One, the story of Narcissus, another, the hymn Silent Night. And this one is telling it through the mythic lens of a dream. From my dream diary, age 10. We were primitive people. Daddy had to hunt for our food. When he gave me fish eggs to eat, snakes kept hatching out of them.
Thank you.
You know, what struck me about this when I came on it, we were primitive people. And in the dream, we were ancient people, like Stone Age people. But thinking back on it, there was a lot of primitive emotion flying around that household. And so the dream, as I think they always do, the dream nailed it. It knew exactly what was going on, and it said so.
Yeah.
And it also is full of allusions, which I wouldn't have expected my 10-year-old self to be able to make. There is a biblical passage that I must have heard in Sunday school where it said something, I can't quote it exactly, but something to the effect of, who among you, if your child asks for food, would give him a stone? So this goes, when he gave me fish eggs to eat, snakes kept hatching out of them. And snakes as a bad kind of food and a poor substitute for emotional nourishment, I guess, would be one way to think of it.
Yeah. And was the language, as you just read it now, daddy had to hunt for our food, was that already in there like that, or did you change a lot when you wrote it in the poem?
No, that's a direct transcription of the dream journal. I still have that dream diary. In fact, it's in this room somewhere. And I came upon it years and years later. I'd forgotten that I had ever done that. And it was quite interesting because I was suddenly receiving emails from somebody who said he knew me and was close friends with me as a child, but I had no memory of him whatsoever. And then I opened up this dream diary, and every other dream was about this person, but I had no conscious memory of him.
And why do you think that is?
I don't know, but it was quite an odd way to re-meet somebody.
Yeah.
I had a diary, in the same diary, I had the actual diary, which was as dull as it could possibly be. And every single entry began, woke up. And woke up, period, ate breakfast, period, went to school, period, came home, period. And it was like that, day after day after day. But then in the back is this short list of dreams, and the dreams tell everything that the diary didn't tell.
Yeah.
And what I love about dreams and poems, too, in very similar ways, is that I feel like they cut through all that boring plotting, woke up, ate breakfast, went to school, came home, watched TV, went to bed. Language that we use all the time in our lives. And they cut right to the core of things. And I was telling somebody the other day that when I'm at a party and I'm having an awkward conversation, I feel so tempted just to say, what is the most interesting thing you dreamed lately? And that just cuts right to the chase. It cuts right to the emotional core of things.
Have you actually done that or just been tempted?
No, but I'm going to try it next time I'm in an awkward conversation.
The feeling that I had when reading Eccentric Votive Offering in the magazine was, wow, what just happened?
Oh,
you know, like
good.
I feel like a spell was cast on me. You
oh,
know, so
that's
that
what
was,
I love to hear.
Yeah, and I wonder what the origin story was for that poem.
It's kind of a checklist of what you need to do to pray or to offer devotion. And so somehow I wanted in this poem to drive the ego out of it. So I immediately started it with subjectless verbs, half psalter and breviary, half hymn book. Like, I've got this, I've got this, I've got this, I've got this. Now am I ready to speak?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, would you like to read it?
Sure. Okay. Here it is. Eccentric Votive Offering. Have psalter and breviary, have hymn book, have laid fingers on rosary strings, plucked like lyres their clatterwood, coughed incense, adored precisely as instructed, stood passion-tied vigil, then sexted at noon. Cast bone die to prophesy dyings, told beads their more sorrowful mysteries, rehallowed insomnia to Compline, then matins, August sky vested in purple surplice. Had ears to hear stern sermons, and so sang back against utter depravity, anti-antiphonal. Droned under song's cacophony during evensong. Left breadcrumb trails through wine chalices, deified. Defiled, sprayed holy water from the bristles of an aspergillum as if flailing a scourge. Reconsecrated cursed tablets to ever more jealous gods. De-sooted candle snuffer silver, chanted exorcism rites at myself, be gone, be gone, be gone, and all thy fell companions. Told what cannot not be, not to be. Laid votive amulets like this one on little scene altars, into bog slurp, waited centuries for their resurfacing and interpreting. Archaic, ill-understandable, and still resurrecting, mnemonic, delivered out of and back in to oblivion.
Wow, it's so different when you read it. Really, I wish that you had just could have read all the poems and all of your books for me.
Yeah, thank you.
It feels so unstable in a sense. On the one hand, the busy work of the ritual, mm-hmm. and then it seems to be threatened from all sides. You know, there's coughing, and there's sexting, and there's insomnia, and there's cacophony and utter depravity. You even pair these two words, deified and defiled. And I was just wondering if ritual is a way to keep that doom at bay.
That's a great question. I grew up in a very Calvinist Southern Presbyterian church in Georgia, mm-hmm. and I think all through my childhood I had this sense of God as very angry and judgmental. We were constantly being told that we were full of sin and utter depravity. And I remember even as a child thinking, I don't think I'm really that bad. So I think there's a sense in this poem in particular of trying to talk back to that notion of utter depravity, while at the same time feeling a struggle between the holiness of the divine and the defiled nature of being human, of being flesh, of being mortal. Mm-hmm. But from early childhood, faith was something that I clung to, that it comforted me and gave me a sense of an order within the violence and chaos. Mm. And I still feel that way. And I still feel that the mess of the world is part of its divinity in some way that I can't fathom, but believe must be.
And when do you feel that order most clearly?
Most clearly when I'm writing. Writing for me is often a way of gathering up the kind of detritus of the world and pulling it together into a form of language and of rhythm and of sound and noise that pulls it into a space that feels sacred, that feels in my hands, I guess would be another way of saying it, and in the hands of language, which feels to me like a medium where things can multiply in ways that I find it really exciting.
Is it because a word never just means one thing or never says anything clearly?
Yeah, well, that ambiguity I find thrilling and usable. I think of words as being possessed by legions of spirits, because a single word can have so many different meanings. Like an eccentric votive offering, the word sexted is a play on the canonical hours of prayer, the sixth hour of which at noon is sexed. And so the word sexted for me is double inhabited by sexuality and spirituality. Mm-hmm. And so I want the words to be as double inhabited and as multiple as our experience of the world is.
Wow, that makes me reread the end of that poem very differently than I initially had. You know, that part, laid votive amulets like this one on little scene altars into bog slurp, waited centuries for their resurfacing and interpreting, archaic, ill-understandable, and still resurrectant mnemonic delivered out of and back into oblivion. Now, that makes me think that you're talking about words.
I am talking about words, because I'm thinking about the poem itself as a sacred object, hoping that it will be resurrected someday, dug up, and understood for the first time, like a Mayan artifact.
Right.
That oblivion isn't permanent.
Yeah, and when I read your poems, there are so many words in there that, well, first of all, I have to look them up. They're not really the most readily used words. And so it seems also like you're pulling them from oblivion and just,
yeah,
you know, using them.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you had a process for that? Like, do you have little scraps of paper in your pockets at all times to write down a good word that you, you find somewhere?
I have large word lists all the time. I have a big old unabridged dictionary right next to me right now, and I've used it so much that the covers have fallen off, which I kind of love about it. And when I'm writing, I keep it in my lap, and I thumb through it until words start to leap out of the dictionary. It's the only way I can put it. There's a feeling like, the way I put it in a poem one time is that language becomes haptic. You can feel it in your skin. And when that starts to happen, I know I'm going to start writing. I can feel that the textures of them suddenly change. I don't, you know, there are times when I can't write and language is just dead. And then I'll open the dictionary one day and the words are just, you know, crawling out of the dictionary. And often that's the way I start writing. Not from an idea, but from a pile of words. Like looking at eccentric votive offering, the word adored was one of those words that felt like it wanted to be in this poem. Because to adore is to love in a romantic or erotic way. But adoration is also one of the chief things we give to gods when we pray, when we worship, when we do any of the things we do to try to reach the divine and kindle the divine within us. And something about the sound of the word adored with that terminal D sound next to the D of plucked and the D of laid, that heavy, somber D sound sort of clicking through those lines like the rosary beads click against each other.
Yes.
And I'm not consciously thinking I'm going to make a consonant sound that's going to sound like rosary beads clicking, but when I look at it now, I realize unconsciously that's part of what went into the making of those lines when I was writing them.
Can you tell me a little bit about the language that you grew up with?
Oh, it was wonderful. The South, Georgia, I hated Georgia when I was growing up. I hated Macon with a passion. And now I'm, in a lot of ways, deeply regretful of that because I feel like there was a richness to the language and to the history of the place and the music of the place that I really underestimated. But part of it is just a sense of wonderful playfulness and sensitivity to language. And it feels very poetic to me.
And can you remember anything that your mom or your dad or maybe a favorite uncle or something would say, you know?
My grandmother from a tiny town called Vidette, Georgia, she had the most wonderful way of language. And she would say things in such odd ways. Like, for example, somebody gave her a dress and she said, "Take it back. It smells like a dead polecat."
Ah, wow. That is sort of like what you do in poems.
Yeah,
right?
Where you just... I think I imbibed a bit of that, yes.
That's incredible. I mean, I also love how what you now just said reminds me of the whole thesis of your upcoming collection, Proverb, Enigma, Hallelujah. You know, where you're also interested in sort of meaningless proverbs or turns of phrase, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was wondering how you came up with that idea.
It started for me when I was reading a book on schizophrenia where, well, two things in this book. One was a passage where the doctor said, one of my patients once came up to me and asked urgently, "Bloodworm, Baltimore, French fry?" It is very difficult to answer a question like that. So, of course, I had to go write a poem called Bloodworm. Bloodworm, Baltimore, French fry, and try to answer it.
Yeah.
Because I'm really drawn to things that resist answer and coherence and finding ways in which there is a hidden coherence inside them. And the other was... references to tests where psychologists try to understand schizophrenic thought and speech through giving patients proverbs, traditional proverbs to interpret. and asking them what the proverb means to them. And the first one I read was the proverb, people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. And, you know, when neurotypical people are asked to interpret that proverb, they'll say something like, well, if you're vulnerable, you shouldn't attack.
Right.
But the schizophrenic patient who was asked to interpret it said, once I lived in a glass house and all I ever did was wave.
Oh, wow.
Which I thought was just a heartbreakingly transparent and beautiful way of expressing that sense of vulnerability and being seen right through to and being unable to connect, but trying to connect. All I ever did was wave.
Yeah.
So that got me thinking about proverbs and how proverbs are like poems or dreams, and you're trying so hard to cram an enormous amount of idea or thought or wisdom or knowledge into a tiny, very metaphorically charged space. Mm-hmm. And then I started reading about interpretations of proverbs that investigated how normal, supposedly normal people, they're called normals in a lot of the psychological literature, which I find deeply offensive, interpreted proverbs. And it turned out that for many of the proverbs, almost 80% of the normals interpreted them wrong.
Oh, wow.
By the standards of the test. So I started asking everybody I knew to interpret proverbs that I came upon, and started writing from multiple interpretations of the same proverb, which I found fascinating in terms of language, but also in terms of psychology and the whole way we understand the world, because I think we understand the world so differently, but we forget and we assume everybody understands it the way we understand it.
Right, as is sort of exemplified in that word, normals.
Right, yeah.
And what made you interested in schizophrenia?
It's... to me, like dreams, a different way of organizing reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way that seems to me to proceed through association and through metaphor and leaping from one thing to another. There's a tremendous amount of wordplay and punning.
Mm.
I include in the manuscript an interview with a patient who was asked, what are you referring to? And he said, I do not refer. Fur is a covering for the animal kingdom.
That is incredible. I love the freedom of that.
Yeah, the freedom and the wildness and the permission to think differently. Which is not, of course, to minimize the tremendous pain that people with schizophrenia endure.
Yeah.
But to find give a kind of credit to the richness of mind that is at work even in the disorder of schizophrenia.
It's so interesting that you mentioned that, because even in your books before this one, before you started reading that book about schizophrenia and discovered that way of associative linking, you know, where one word brings you into a whole new image, basically. You do that in a lot of your poems, starting many years before you picked up that book. And so I'm wondering, did you feel some sort of kinship with these patients, even though you are a supposed normal?
A supposed normal. I like that. Yeah, I wouldn't presume to feel a kinship with their state of mind, but I do feel a kinship with certain practices of language in poetry and in dreams. Dreams are constantly punning, making reference to words in a way that's very fluid, that takes a word and leaps from the sound of the word to another word that sounds like it. And once you follow that pun, the dream comes to make a lot of sense that it made no sense before you understood that there was a wordplay that was taking the dream from one scene to another.
Well, I'd love for you to read this one poem where you do follow the puns, or you follow the words sort of wherever they lead. And it's that poem called Like Warm Ice Cubes on page 46.
Okay, thank you.
It's kind of a long poem, and it may be helpful if maybe we break it up a little bit.
Sure. So this poem comes out of a very bizarre psychological study that builds on the proverb interpretation studies, but takes it a few steps further. So these are proverbs that were invented by a psychologist that were, they wrote proverbs that were deliberately stripped of meaning to see what would happen if they asked people to interpret something that didn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. And a father is like warm ice cubes is the one I decided to write from. So the poem is a meditation on being a father and having a father. So I'll read the first section. Like warm ice cubes. A father is like warm ice cubes? I can't get any meaning out of that one, Doc. As to interpret deliberately absurd proverbs, most normal subjects refused. But 3 out of 4 in psychosis dared explicate. To a wet bird flies at night. A patient said, "You may not know the hour or time that God shall come," and so confirmed his diagnosis. God is a sopped bird, night flying. A father is water's phase transition, trembling between turbid, crystalline, and translucent thermal wet. Oxymoronic, as the anomalous proverb, night flown and deep drenched in its unmeaning.
Yeah. I'm so fascinated by how quickly you managed to tease meaning out of this meaningless sentence.
Yeah, well, to me, it's not meaningless at all, which is fascinating because a big part of this project of this book is to investigate what meaning is and where it comes from and how it's made. Uh-huh. And I was talking to a close friend of mine when her father was ill, not long before he passed away. And I mentioned this proverb to her, fathers are like warm ice cubes. And she almost fell out of her chair and she said, yes, they are.
Yeah.
Which I think, again, coming back to the language of dreams, the language of metaphor, the language of poems, it's not literally true that an ice cube can be warm or that a father can be like a warm ice cube. And yet ice cube becomes a metaphor for the father's, the way that men are socialized, I think, and fathers are expected to be emotionally remote and cold.
Yeah. You're a father yourself, and you adopted your son, right?
That's right.
Was that in some way a relief, you know, given your own family history and the way that certain things like addiction definitely travel in our genetic code? Was it a relief to have a son not biologically related to you?
It's wonderful having a son who's not biologically related to me. I don't know about a relief. But my son was born in Korea, and I don't know. There's something about not having that genetic expectation, I guess would be one way to put it, of similarity. And still feeling incredibly similar and incredibly close, that I find very beautiful. I think one of the things is my father, I was worried, scared about becoming a father because my father was, to me, often somebody I feared. And I did not want to be a figure that my son would fear. I don't want to reproduce the relationship I had with my father. Mm-hmm. And so this poem is partly a meditation on how do you do that. So the second section, a father is as oxymoronic as the word oxymoron, which means, after all, sharp, dull, acute, moronic in Greek. Acute, moronic, the meaning-stripped proverbs provide, the researchers say, a meaningful dimension in a clinician's repertory. Have you ever held an ice cube in your fist? Long enough to feel the caverns of its sharp, dull collapse from the body warmth trickle at its core? Heteromorphic nonsuch. A father in his natural form is rigid, hexagonal, strictly fixed. Whoever even tries to interpret him is prima facie unstable. He will surrender his self-structure only when touched and so destabilized and transfigured. Melting's a speed up of the molecules, so they can disorder themselves and break their self-attraction, and so unstiffen, slide around each other, and get away. Cubic, liqueous, semi-vitreous. A father buoys himself on what's becoming of his new loosed, unexpectedly warm flown outward toward others' self. Oxymoronic's antonym is plain, which means without intricacies or difficulties. My father, who told me at 11 never to cry again, boys aren't allowed to look so weak. When I was 13, blubbered over how drunk he always was, how ashamed I must be of him, said, "Bruce, can you cry too?" "No, sir," I said, "I can't." What I'm struggling to get at in this poem is that I wanted to be a kind of father who was liquid, who was flexible, who was available emotionally, who was vulnerable in a way my father didn't often allow himself to be. And this moment I talked about where he asked me if I could cry too, he wanted me to be vulnerable with him, but he had already taught me that it was not acceptable for males to be vulnerable. So it was just, I remember feeling this mixed signal, like, wait, you told me not to do that, and now you're telling me to do it. Yeah. And it was very confusing.
Yeah. What is a way in which your son has changed your idea of what a man is?
I interviewed him for this poem and asked him, what does this proverb mean to you? My father is like warm ice cubes, and incorporated his answer into the poem, which surprised me, because his answer was that a father should be a form of stability and structure, and the liquid father could boil over very easily, but the ice cube father keeps it together. And so when I asked him, well, what kind of father am I? He goes, well, ice cube, of course. Which is not the sense of ice cube I was thinking at all. And so that pointed out to me the difference in the way a single metaphor could be understood.
Right. We're back to this ambiguity that you were talking about.
Yeah. And I assumed that an ice cube would always be a negative image, but for him it was a positive image, image of structure and stability and consistency, where the liquid father was something that could just wash away and blow over and boil over.
Yeah. Yes. Do you want to read till the end of the poem?
Yes. With intricacies, with difficulties. A father stab blunts his way into thaw, which is a spreading defect of the crystal, the breaking of all its lattices, what it is. The ice cube father keeps it together, my son Jin said, while the liquid father has much less of a spine and can boil over very easily. Well, so which am I? I asked. Ice cube, of course. to differentiate schizophrenics from normals. Researchers developed the silly sentences test. Subjects vote true or false to statements like, beefsteaks crawl on their bellies. True, a patient with schizophrenia answered, confirming his diagnosis. A cow is still alive before it's slaughtered. So it could be true. They could crawl on their bellies a bit. A father is like warm ice cubes. True, I say, we could be. A collapsed cube's side could crawl on its belly a bit, inside the crystal, where the parallel-faced hard amalgamation disintegrates as ice walls give themselves over to the liqueous state they once knew, vibrating faster within and quickened so they can reach toward a sun by shedding the voids between their lattices. Thawed dribbled ice. Freeze crystalled melt. Passing out of their self-possession, coming warm thick closer and getting through.
Thank you. Do you still write your dreams down, by the way?
Yes, I do. I've recorded 50 dreams in the last 6 weeks.
And is that because it was a particularly fruitful couple of weeks, dream-wise?
Well, I'm teaching right now a course that I often teach on poetry and dreams, which I love. And as part of that, we try to pay very close attention to our dreams.
Mm. And is that distance enough to make any kind of sense out of your dream? Or does it need to be sunk into the bog slurp for a while?
I don't often use dreams or dream images directly in a poem, because I think there's a certain translation from what I like to call dreamlish, you know, the language of dreams,
right,
into the language of English. But I constantly use the ideas and the images that are haunting my dreams. And I think our dreams give us a less linear and a much more honest way of dealing with the world and with what's going on in our lives and in our mind.
Is that something that your son does too, or is that just your thing that you're happy that you can do?
He has a very healthy attitude toward the unknown and the unconscious, and he has a very good way of talking about things that might otherwise be taboo.
How old is he?
He's 22.
So does he still live at home, or did he move out?
No, he's in college in Los Angeles at the Musicians Institute. He does a lot of rap, and his songs are wonderful. He's very talented verbally, and so his songs are full of enormous amounts of wordplay, and, it makes me happy.
I wonder where he gets that.
I can't imagine.
Bruce Beasley is the author of 9 poetry collections, among which Summer Mystagogia, which won the Colorado Prize for Poetry in 1996, selected by Charles Wright, Lord Brain, Theophobia, All Soul Parts Returned, and his upcoming collection, Proverb Enigma Hallelujah. He also teaches at Western Washington University in Bellingham. You can find out more about his poetry on the Poetry Foundation website. The music in this episode is by Todd Sikafoos. I'm Helena de Groot, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.